Right. One thing I've realised as a teacher is that sometimes all you're doing is, sometimes in these talks, all you're really doing is just talking about a subject. It's not really that you have to draw a conclusion on the basis of what we hear, it's rather that it's just about reminding us about certain aspects of life and how life works, in order that people can go away with those ideas and see whether, you know, and it's just a support to people's meditation. So tonight I thought I'd talk about how objects influence. So we'll be looking at the interconnectedness of life, about conditionality, about how objects relate to one another, and the kind of force and energy that they have through that relationship. So I call tonight's talk Influence. What we discover as we practice Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, a lot, we begin to discover how interconnected everything is. We begin to see that indeed things aren't separate, and that we become more aware of objects and the power of objects and the power that they have in relationship with one another. Objects do have a tremendous influence on us. Take, for example, in the macroscopic cosmic level, planets and black holes and suns and the tremendous electromagnetic forces that operate around them, the tremendous pull of gravity, and how they influence, how the stars and the planets influence one another and influence us. I was watching a programme on the Voyager probes that they sent out in the 70s, and how the Voyager probe was positioned in its approach to a planet so that as it passed the planet, the gravitational pull of the planet would act as a slingshot and send the Voyager probe onto the next planet in the solar system. That's really clever. That's fantastic. So there is this influence that the planets exert, massive influence. And we know, for instance, of the full moon, don't we? The influence that the full moon can have on us. And if you're not aware of that, perhaps more mindfulness around full moon and you'll discover for yourself. So on that huge macroscopic level, objects do have a massive influence. But what about, say, something like something more mundane, for instance, decorating and putting objects into one of your rooms at home, perhaps getting into the old feng shui or something like that, and being quite deliberate about where you place objects, and the sort of colours that you use in a certain room, because of the kind of ambience, the kind of atmosphere that's generated through the positioning of a plant pot, positioning of a settee, where you put things in a room. It will all exert a more subtle influence than planets, but it will exert an influence. It will have an influence. Where you put something does matter. As you know, the way the House of Inner Tranquility is run, it's run very much in a way as to help support the arising of positive mental qualities like tranquility. So everything is kept very tidy, everything's very neat. If something does is out of place, it looks really obvious, because the whole centre is designed in the way things are placed. And the colour schemes and all of this is all about the influence that colours and shapes actually exert on the mind. Yes. And then we come on to things like art. I came across the lady on TV, the lady who did the conceptual artist who did the rubbish tipped onto her bed. art piece. And, you know, and it's rubbish on a bed. How is that art? But she explained it, and she explained it in context of a clock that somebody was holding, and the person asked, well, is this clock art? And she said, no. And the person said, could it be art? And she said, yes, if it's placed in a context. And art depends upon a context. So an object gains a certain power, a certain force, a certain influence in relation to another object. So for her, the rubbish on the bed was the way it fell, the way she repositioned things. It wasn't just random, there was a context for her. And that's what gave it the power. And the idea with art, of course, is that that influence then influences the observer, and we have an emotional response to the art through the clever placement of the objects, the colours, and so forth. So again, this is the idea is that these objects, as it were, emit an influence, and that influence is in the context and in the relationship with other objects. Another one that came to mind was Salvador Dali's Mounting Clock, was juxtaposing these concepts of time and melting, which is just very evocative. And the whole idea is that it does prompt, I have no idea what it means, but it does prompt, and it can prompt, an emotional response. There's a lot of, in art, they've done a lot with the theory of colour and how different colours in relationship to one another create an emotional response, can actually create visual illusions when certain colours are placed together. So that there is an influence, there is a force in those colours when they are combined. And then I come on to what would a talk be? I don't think I'll ever now do a talk without some quantum weirdness being involved in it. Again, the physicists have discovered this thing called entanglement. I've probably mentioned it so often, but it's so fascinating. Well, they call it spooky action at a distance. This is where you fire a UV light onto a certain kind of crystal, and what happens is photons get split, subatomic particles of some kind called photons get split off, and they have what they call them daughters, and they're like siblings, and so you have more than one, you have like two of these photons. And what they discovered was, and this is really fascinating, that at the time that they split off, they don't know what their characteristics are. They don't know how they vibrate or how they wiggle or what they do. And so what they do, they measure one of these sibling photons, and through measuring it, through bringing human consciousness to bear upon it, it then gains a discrete knowable nature. It can be measured. And they discovered that the other photon, which is in another place, immediately consciousness and measuring happens with the one photon, the other photon takes on exactly the same qualities. So even though it's separated in space, have I got that right, Trevor? I think I'm almost there, aren't I? I'm not a scientist by nature. But essentially they found that a change in the one photon caused another change in another photon, which wasn't located in the same place. And they said, well, theoretically, this would be true if it was an infinite distance. It would still change the moment the other one changed, which is really quite astonishing. Yes. People also are a great influencing factor, as we know. I did recall that the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, created this teaching, and here we are 2,500 years ago, all in agreement that it's a really pretty important thing. What an incredible influence. So we've had, I was talking about influence spatially, not one thing could influence another, even at a huge spatial distance. Time also, there can be a huge influence from the past, which really has a great influence upon us now. So 2,500 years ago, the Buddha has a tremendous influence. Of course, influence between people is incredibly strong. Parents towards children, children's influence on parents, husband's influence on wife, wife's influence on husband, influence of work colleagues. Oh, it goes on and on. Oh, here I go, I watched another TV program. You probably think I watch too much TV. The Sports Personality of the Year awards last Sunday, and I couldn't help but notice that everyone who won an award, the first thing they said was, it wasn't just me. That it required this, you know, so many people in order to make their dream come true. So it's always a team effort. Truly, we do not stand alone. Yes, there are other kinds of influences, perhaps not quite so positive. The influence of adverts, of course, especially at Christmas. I've been watching too much TV, haven't I? Because the example I'm going to give you is perfume and aftershave adverts. Because there was a double influence at work there. Firstly, of course, the advertising is trying to, this might sound a bit cynical, but trying to get us to buy things we don't need a lot of the time. Trying to influence our greed, trying to make us want those things by making them appear very, very desirable. And also the one with perfume and aftershaves, of course. Smell is the great attractor, isn't it? And of course, people like to wear perfume and aftershave because it does influence the way other people perceive you. I certainly remember. You should always know when to stop, I think. Quit while you're ahead. And of course, in the media, we have the media can be very manipulative and wants to influence our views. And of course, there's been been a bit of a political hot potato, how much media access media barons have to politicians and this kind of thing. And it's just to give a sense of how human beings are perpetually trying to influence one another. So with influence, there is always, of course, an ethical dimension. And what is a good influence and what is a bad influence? As every parent's nightmare, of course, is for their kids to fall in with the wrong crowd. How do we judge what's good and what's bad? Perhaps we can trace it by saying that bad behaviour are those that are bound up with ignorance, craving and hatred. And they're bad because they produce such painful results, both for the individual and the people around the individual. And good behaviour is the restraint of that ignorance, craving and hatred, above all else. Yes, of course, there's the positive acting out good actions, but really it's the restraint of the tendency to ignore, to be greedy and to be hateful. So there are, of course, many, many influences, both good and bad. Of course, that is the reason for our Sangha, that's the reason for our community, which is to create, hopefully, a good, positive influence. If I'm not influencing you, then I'm giving up. Do you know what I mean? But hopefully it's a positive and a benign influence, meaning that, you know, there's no personal investment there. But it is, the Buddha Sangha is something very special. It teaches us about action and result, about karma. It teaches about the benefit of keeping precepts, developing the parami, mindfulness, loving kindness, and all this crazy insight stuff as well. And so it is very influential and hopefully a very positive influence. And so every meditator needs to be aware that the world around them is influencing them. It is influencing your meditation, the choices you make, the sorts of people that you socialise with, the things you talk about, the things you watch on TV, things you read in newspapers. Everything does have an influence. And so a Buddhist meditator on their journey does become aware of these things and does start to make choices about what kinds of influences they want. If perhaps their social group is, generally speaking, quite doubtful of all things spiritual, and yet the individual meditator is becoming more spiritual and more mindful and more meditative, then there tends to be, it's not enforced, but there tends to be a natural, just a movement towards the positive influence of people of a like mind. It's certainly happened to me. So action and result, yes. Kamma itself is of course hugely influential. Our actions, our behaviour is hugely influential. The way we are perceived by others, the way we perceive ourselves in the present is based in how we behave, and behaviour is of three kinds. There's our physical actions, there's our verbal behaviour, but there's also our mental actions. And of the three, the Buddha said, our mental actions are the most powerful in generating the results of kamma. So it's the most powerful. So the way we think does influence the world around us. It influences the way we perceive. It influences our present. It also influences our future. Kamma is responsible for the production of further rebirth. So the way we behave now is materially affecting our future. Yes, the example here I gave was of the terrible revelations about a certain DJ that we all know about that occurred. And, you know, it's nobody can escape their kamma, and it may concern many people that he died before all these revelations came out, but nobody escapes experiencing the results of their actions. And that's what having a bigger view of life that incorporates rebirth, that's what it gives you. It gives you an ethical dimension, because you realise you're not going to get away with it. But also you realise the good actions that you do will produce really positive, comfortable situations for you in the future. So kamma has its influence in time and space. There's a remote influence that we get when we practice loving kindness. When you practice loving kindness towards somebody else, it's always at a distance when you think about it, in terms of the physical. There's always a physical. And yet, many people claim, and I'm one of them, that you know that you come to be intuitively aware that somebody is receiving the loving kindness. As one's concentration develops with loving kindness, it can be that an image of that person can become really quite solid in the mind as you're actually giving, you know, doing the loving kindness towards them. And you can actually see them smiling. Sometimes, no matter what you try, you can't give that loving kindness to them at all. They just absolutely point blank refuse to accept it. Sometimes, careful how I put this. Sometimes it feels like you're having a conversation with that person. And although it might seem strange, what concentration meditation begins to develop is the intuition that we are primarily mental beings. I don't mean that in the wrong way. I mean we're mental beings in terms of we're primarily mental in nature. Now that's saying the same thing. You know what I mean though? With a physical extension. And that actually, on a mental level, we are all actually talking to one another constantly. That there is a relationship on the mental level. And as somebody practices concentration and loving kindness, for instance, more and more, that becomes really profoundly clear and obvious. And sometimes people, yeah, they don't want your loving kindness. They don't want you to disturb them, or they're in a bad mood, or it's just not the right time. Yes, so that's it. So even though somebody might be on the other side of the world, your loving kindness still very much connects on the mental level. That distance is really no object at all. Now, my next story for you, you don't have to believe if you don't want to. I'm just saying it because it's just such a great concept that I just wanted to say it, really. And this is to do with karma and time. So it's possible for your karma to affect your future, but can your karma affect your past? Yes, I told you, you don't have to, you can just listen to this story. A meditator recalled himself years previously when he was really depressed, really isolated, really withdrawn, wanted just to be by himself, and was in a room, dark room, all by himself, feeling very sorry for himself. And the meditator recalls that he experienced, at that time, he experienced this amazing rapture and beautiful, tranquil feelings come over him. And at that time, he wasn't a meditator, so he didn't really have a conceptual base to understand what was happening to him. But he had this intuition that it was coming from somewhere else, and that there was a kind of underlying message, and the message was, don't worry, you'll be fine, you'll get through. And it was only more recently that the meditator remembered this. And so the meditator, being a bit of a wag, thought about it for a second, and he thought, oh. And what he did was he sent metta to his own self in the past. So was it that person receiving his own metta from the future? Time and space on the mental level, the boundaries are not so clear. Shall I put it like that? But like I say, I'm just having fun. You don't have to pull things like that. That's true. I don't know. I know that the story as told was genuine. The person thought there might be something to it, but I'll leave it for you. One thing about loving kindness you should bear in mind is, of course, that you're not doing the loving kindness to manipulate or control the other person. The influence needs to be benign. The true influence of practicing loving kindness is to develop the culture of our own minds. And if it is that through that process you begin to get an inkling for things not understood before about the mental level and operating on the mental level, then it's just important that we bear that in mind and don't allow it to become manipulative. Because look, just to reiterate what the Buddha said, our mental actions are the most powerful in generating results. And then we move on to in terms of influence, we move on to the wonderful world of Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, and conditionality. it begins to become evident the more we practice the observation of transience, and we're looking at all these thoughts, feelings, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, and what have you. We're seeing all these discrete moments of experience arising and passing away. And we begin to get insights into the fact that everything that arises does so dependent upon other things, that nothing stands alone, that true life is interconnected, that a sound can only arise if there's a working ear. You can't have a sound without hearing consciousness, hearing. So hearing is dependent upon there being a sound in order to hear. And you begin to discover that with all these objects, that there is a relationship between objects. And you begin to detect that relationship is actually a force all of its own. It is an influence. In the higher teaching of Buddhism, the Abhidhamma, there is a list of 24 different kinds of influences between objects. So it's not just the objects alone, but it's their relationship, it's the context, it's the power that's generated between the various objects. And so they've actually been able to distinguish not just the object, the true nature of the objects, but their conditioning force as well. And there are 24 of them, and I won't be going through them at all. But what happens, you begin to discover that those conditional forces are more real than the objects themselves. That really it's what we call life is made up of these conditioning forces, the play of these conditioning forces at work. And everything that comes to be, and that is apparently separate, that is apparently separate, is indeed not separate at all. And it's only the appearance is separation. That at heart, really, what we take to be objects is merely the shadow that's cast by the play of these conditioning forces. And you come to realize, gradually, that you can't really control these conditional forces. That despite our best attempts to manipulate and control and force them into the shapes that we want them to be, they always escape our control. They have their own nature. They are non-self. And the meditator, in the end, does the most astonishing thing, that they surrender the control. They surrender the belief that they can control. And so all that's left are the conditioning forces at work. And the paradox is, you discover through giving up the control, the manipulation, that there is perfect harmony, that these conditioned and conditioning forces go to make up the world, the universe, everything. And we come to completely understand that everything is in relationship with everything else. In reality, there is no separation at all. There is just this wonderful ocean of, well, it depends how you want to describe it, because then it's not even really objects. It's just, I don't want to say force, because that sounds like we're getting into Star Wars territory, but there's just this magical flow of conditionality. It's the best way I can put it. But yeah, we do come to see that really you can't separate anything out at all. And that really starts to make sense of things like, well, it doesn't even start to make sense. You completely comprehend what the quantum physicist is struggling to comprehend. There's a perfect understanding of how it is you can have two photons either end of the universe, and they both imitate each other perfectly. You can understand, you have perfect comprehension of how it is that mind and body come into being, and how it is that it is volition that is the force, the influence that determines the kind of mind and body that arises. All through just paying attention to reality as it unfolds moment by moment. It's really, the more you contemplate it, the more amazing it gets. Yeah, the last thing I wanted to talk about was the influence of the enlightened mind. Because once you have, to try and put across the difference between the unenlightened mind and the enlightened mind, you have this flow of, this infinite flow of phenomena. Everything arising and passing away due to conditions. So there's just this constant ocean of states arising and passing away. In the unenlightened mind, the mind that believes there is a separate self, separate to all of that, that belief has an influence on that flow, on the flow of phenomena. It causes a most terrible warping of that flow. So it stops that flow from doing what it naturally wants to do. And it's forever doing that. It's always getting in the way. In the unenlightened mind, there is just the flow of phenomena, because there is no held assumption of a separate self. So there is no warp. And that's the difference between the enlightened mind and the unenlightened mind, is that the enlightened mind is just the universe of phenomena arising and passing away perfectly naturally, just doing whatever it needs to do without any manipulation or control. It's just life expressing itself perfectly. In the unenlightened mind, there's always this, shouldn't be like this, shouldn't be like that, should be different, don't want it to be like this, don't want it to be like that. And it's always trying to cut up and change and interfering with that flow. Now, with the enlightened mind, you see, because you've got this, because it's just this perfect flow and there's nothing interfering with it, for people who are on the spiritual search, who themselves want to come to this same understanding, that is extremely, the influence of the enlightened mind is extremely enticing, but you're not quite sure why. It's like there's a quality, but you can't quite put your finger on what that quality is about the enlightened mind that you're just very much drawn to as a spiritual seeker. And in India, they have the concept of darshan. Do you know what darshan is? Darshan is being in the presence of the enlightened mind, essentially. So people go and want to be in the presence of the enlightened mind because that enlightened mind is just, it's not even at one with the flow in the universe. It is the flow of the universe. And therefore, they want to be in with that flow because there is an influence that the enlightened mind has on the unenlightened mind. It begins to bring it into the flow. It begins, that's right, it begins to bring it into the flow. So people are less passionate, are less desirous of life to be different, are more accepting, are happier, are more at peace in the presence of the enlightened mind. And so that's the concept of darshan. So really the enlightened mind isn't that they're looking for something from the teacher, or rather put it around the other way, it's not that the teacher has something that they can give the student. It's more of an absence. It's an absence, and that's what makes it so difficult to quantify. It's very difficult to quantify an absence. I really want that, but there's nothing there, kind of thing. And so, yeah, so that, you know, that is the most incredible influence to have as a spiritual seeker, is that notion of darshan, or being with the teacher. And of course, in the end, we come back to the greatest influence of all as Buddhist practitioners, which is the darshan of the Buddha himself, which it appears is still healthy and strong and ongoing. And it's due to carry on for a good while yet. So the Buddha did say that, to finish, the Buddha did say that his dispensation was due to last 5,000 years, and we're 2,500 years into it. So if anyone's worried about Friday, you can put your mind at rest. The beautiful thing is that if I'm wrong, nobody will know, because we won't be here to know. So I feel pretty confident about that. Okay, so I think we'll draw a close there.